Welcome into another edition of the Dan and Victory Podcast, only on MusketeerReport.com. As always, I'm Rick. He's Dan. Dan, crazy, crazy last 2 days in the sports world.
Well, that is definitely true, Rick. First of all, I can confirm for all of our listeners that Rick and I are actual corporeal human beings. You can come down and you can harass us on press row at the CentOS Center for most games. So you don't have to worry about this being some sort of internet hoax.
You could even Skype us if you want, like we're doing with each other right now, although that doesn't sound too good. Anyway, let's just quickly move on. I know you guys have been listening to Teo talk all day. We may touch on that later in the podcast, but first we've got plenty of Xavier talk to get to, starting with, of course, the AD search. Mike Babinski is gone to Georgia Tech. Where does this leave Xavier? Who's next? We'll get into all of that. Xavier, 3-game winning streak after they closed out their non-conference schedule on a 4-game losing skid. We'll talk about what's made them successful and, of course, Samaje's big shot last night against St. Bonaventure. And we'll also get into D. Davis's injury and let you know where that stands, as well as a preview of the LaSalle game and a few more nuggets as we move on. There's your favorite word right there, Dan. Nuggets. I had to throw that in for you.
Love those nuggets.
Love nuggets.
This, by the way, is podcast number 18. And unlike Jay Gruden, I always know who number 18 is and where he is on the field.
Better believe it. That Beast Snow will be happy about that one. You know, he's a big AJ Green guy. But let's go ahead and dive right into the Xavier stuff, starting with Babinski. Gone to Georgia Tech. We found out, I guess it was Wednesday morning, that everyone kind of knew for sure. We talked about it a little bit Tuesday night on Musketeer Report. It's not a surprise. Let's just start there. I don't think it's much of a surprise to any of the fans, as judged by the reaction from the message board. It was not near as toxic or as many people kind of freaking out as I thought we might see. And I think that just speaks to everyone kind of expected this at some point, and they're pleased with what Mike has done and know that he was looking to better his career and give himself more opportunities.
Well, let's start with that. I think maybe the place to start is to look back over Mike Babinski's tenure at Xavier and talk about sort of what's been accomplished during that period of time. Mike served as AD. He had two stints as AD, really, 98 to 2004. He was on the fundraising side of the university from 04 to 06 and then returned to the AD role at that time. So I think if you add it up, I believe he spent like 18 years in total as that's not right. He spent about 10 years in total as the athletic director. Among his achievements during that time, he oversaw the transition of the athletic department into the CentOS Center in 2000. He was responsible for hiring Thad Mata. He was responsible for bringing in Sean Miller as associate head coach. He was responsible for the hiring of Chris Mack. Outside men's basketball, I should say, he oversaw unprecedented success for XU's women's basketball program, reaching the Elite Eight twice in his tenure. The baseball program, the soccer program with NCAA tournament appearances, a lot of the Olympic sports with guys and girls getting further into NCAA competition than ever before. And then, you know, he was a guy that was well respected outside his profession. As everybody knows, I think, listening to this, he's the chair of the NCAA tournament selection committee this year. He served on the committee last year. And so it's been a pretty impressive run for Mike Babinski. And I think one of the reasons why everyone is sort of at peace with his decision to move on is that you cannot argue that he hasn't left X's athletic department in a much better place than where it was when he came in. And so I think that when you look at Mike Babinski's tenure, it's been one of incredible success for Xavier, and it's been a relationship that's benefited both parties immensely.
Well, you're right, and it certainly has. But you brought up an interesting point when we were talking about this off the podcast in emails earlier. And that's that. Yeah, sure, Mike did leave the program in a better position. There's no denying that. But didn't Thad Mata and Sean Miller do the same thing? And everyone was mad when those guys left. Here's the difference to me about there's a few differences to me when you talk about the way fans reacted to Thad and Sean leaving versus the way it happened with Babinski. One, we knew about Thad and Sean being involved in coaching searches both times, like leading up in the days leading up to the decision, and we kind of heard the I'm going to stick around. You know, they kind of made comments that meant that they wanted to stay at Xavier. So I think that's part of it, that people feel like, oh, they went back on their word. The other thing that there is I think people see this as, you know, the coach is like kind of part of the team, and they're walking out on their guys or whatever the case may be. So I think that plays into it a little bit. And then the third thing, which is probably the biggest, there's no denying that there's no football program at Xavier. You can't argue with that. So
right.
Whatever you want to say about Mike Babinski, you can say he needed to run a football program before he was going to move into the elite jobs with football programs that he wanted to take, maybe like Notre Dame, which is his alma mater, which I think a lot of us expect that's what he wants. I think that plays into it a lot, is that people have a pretty high – Xavier fans have a pretty high – hold Xavier's basketball program in pretty high regards and rank it among some of the elite in the country, I think, if you're a Xavier fan. So when you look at it as, oh, they're leaving for another basketball team, well, Xavier's as good as anyone. We can go as far as those teams. But when you look at it from an AD perspective, there is no football program at Xavier. So I think that plays a big role in this.
Oh, I think that's absolutely, absolutely true. I think another thing is that people – well, first of all, to go back to the first thing you said, I absolutely agree with you that the coach, that fans have a much greater connection with a coach than they do with an administrator. At the end of the day, it's Chris Mack, Sean Miller, Thad Matta, whoever, who's out there, you know, coaching up the players, who's you know, firing up the fans at the games, who's the face of the program. The athletic director, not really in that role. I think Mike Babinski is higher profile to Xavier fans than a lot of ADs might be, because X has had so many high-profile coaching searches, and because he's been such a bulwark of stability for the university over the years, and also just because he does such a great job, because he's so savvy in the media, because he just presents such a positive image. So from my perspective, that has a lot to do with it. But I think another thing is that you're right. I mean, if Mike Babinski's ambition is to one day have one of those elite jobs at the very top of his chosen profession, and I'm talking about AD at Notre Dame, Ohio State, Texas, USC, whatever school you want to bring up, it probably was not going to be possible for him to jump directly from Xavier into one of those jobs. You're talking about a guy who's in his mid-50s. His kids are out of college. He's given almost two decades to Xavier. And it's logical that he would want to make that intervening step and try his skill at a school that does have big-time football, in the hopes that he can prove himself and get to that final level that he wants to get to. So I think people are just – also, let's face it. The career arc for an athletic director is a lot closer to what, you know, normal people in the business world do than coaching. You know, we all sort of understand that idea of moving up the corporate ladder and gaining more responsibility and maybe moving from institution to institution, searching for more prestige and pay. So I think people appreciate what Babinski's done and appreciate that now is a time that probably makes sense for him to move on.
That's a good point. So the next question obviously becomes, where does this leave Xavier? I mean, you're right. He's been through some big, high-profile coaching searches, and he's come out looking great in all three so far. I mean, I guess there's people still out there questioning Chris Mack, but two out of three Sweet 16s to start, three NCAA tournaments in his first 3 years. I'd say you're off to a pretty good start with that hire as well. So
sure,
if you look
sure.
at it from that perspective, he's done three great hires. I understand why people are worried. And, of course, when you factor in the conference realignment thing, that has a big deal. That's a big part of it as well, of why people are saying, you know, well, what's going to happen? This is bad timing for Xavier. I think what has happened with the conference realignment thing is we have given probably – way too much credit to the role Mike Babinski is playing in this, from what I've come to learn by talking to sources over the last several days. He is high profile. He has a lot of great contacts from his NCAA gig on the selection committee and now being the chair, obviously. And he does a great job of representing the university, and a lot of people like Mike. So I do think that has helped Xavier in some regards. But at the end of the day, Xavier, for one, is basically already in this whatever this new conference is going to be formed by the Catholic Seven, from the way I understand. And two, they didn't want Xavier because Mike Babinski was the AD. They wanted Xavier because they fit the profile. They're a desirable basketball program and school. They've got a good market in Cincinnati. That's the reason Xavier is asked to join this new conference, not because their athletic director was Mike Babinski. As far as, well, doesn't he need to be around to work out these deals, or Xavier's going to be screwed if at the table if they don't have an acting AD with that, you know, has the chops of Mike Babinski? That's not the case. This is being played out at a presidential level and other high administrators. To be honest, Mike probably wasn't going to have much say in any of these deals, even though, yes, he has been involved in the conversations and he knows what's going on. He wasn't going to be the ones making decisions. So as far as that, I think you can breathe easy. I think Xavier will be fine with the conference realignment stuff. And when it comes to finding another athletic director for future coaching searches and things like that, sure. You gotta put faith, I guess, in the administration that they're going to make the right hire, and I can understand why people are a little bit worried about that right now.
Well, you know, one thing that you did mention about, yeah, the conference realignment's being played out at much higher levels, and probably from Mike Babinski's perspective, this 2-year period where he's on the selection committee was the best opportunity that he was ever going to have to network, to see a lot of different schools, to see a lot of different jobs. And so that's why I think over the last 2 or 3 seasons, you've seen him flirt with so many positions. And I know that, you know, it's all – a lot of times it's blog posts and so forth, and maybe he wasn't really a candidate at BC or Illinois or Kansas or TCU or whatever, or maybe just some of them. But you know, when there's that much smoke, there's some fire. Another thing about the conference realignment, Rick, is that Mike is going to stay on until the end of the academic year, or at least pretty close to the end of the academic year. I think he's going to be at X until March 23rd. So to the extent that he does play a role in these negotiations, he'll still be around to help grease the skids and to help assist the transition over the next couple of months.
Right, and that's a good point. And another thing that we should bring up when you're talking about the conference realignment, how long all that'll take to play out, I'm not real sure, but you're right. I mean, he's going to be here for the next few months, and if anything happens right now in the immediate future, put it this way, Xavier's going to have plenty of time to find a competent replacement and figure out who that is before Mike Babinski is even gone. So they're never going to have this period where they have no leader or guidance while trying to figure out these deals with the new conference. So I wouldn't worry about that at all. You know, wrapping the whole thing with Babinski up, I think – you look at where Xavier's program is now, you look at how things have gone, and Mike Babinski was a big part of that success, but the program is much bigger than just Mike Babinski. How much does the athletic director need to do? The hires are important, but this program is going to keep rolling with Chris Mack at the helm for the next few years. There's going to be success. Xavier's still going to be a desirable head basketball coaching job. So, again, don't go off the deep end about this stuff. From what the other thing I've heard from a lot of people, sources that I've been talking to the last couple of days, is that while a lot of people like Mike, and I don't think anyone's like jumping for joy that he's leaving or glad to see him go necessarily, there have been a lot of people have indicated to me that it's probably a good time for both parties that he's going. And just that it's exactly what we've already talked about. He's flirting with all these jobs. He's been looking for an out for 3 years. And I'm not saying he didn't do his job, but you gotta when you're planning on trying to take another job for 3 full years now, there's a lot of other things on your mind other than just the job at hand. I'm not saying he shortchanged Xavier at all, but there have been a lot of people who have indicated to me that it's probably time to get some fresh blood in here with some fresh ideas that is looking to advance Xavier and not looking to leave Xavier necessarily.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough for me to – I don't have access to the same information you do. So I think based on my limited interactions with Mike both on a basketball and on a personal level that, you know, he's a consummate pro.
Without question.
I agree. You know, I'm sad to see him go, because he is a class act. Do I think Xavier will be able to find a administrator that's going to be able to step in and be as good as Mike Babinski tomorrow? Probably not. But they have an opportunity now to find the next Mike Babinski, because in 1998, when they hired Mike Babinski, he was the AD at Akron, and he'd only been an athletic director, a head athletic director for a couple years. And at that point, X was coming off the tenure of Mike's predecessor, Jeff Fogelson, who'd been the AD from 1984 to 1998. So that, to me, is the most interesting thing, is that really it's been two guys, other than the brief Don Rogers interregnum, which is its own story. It's really been two guys over the last 30 years or so that have led this program. And, you know, from my perspective, there are going to be a lot of candidates that look at this job as a great opportunity. And I would expect that X will find somebody that's going to be able to step into Mike's shoes, maybe not be Mike Babinski from day one, but be able to continue the momentum of the program.
As far as potential names out there, we don't have a whole lot to go on right now. And to be honest, I don't know that they've really gotten that far. I'm sure there's plenty of names that they have contacts with already that are going to be considered, and they may have already reached out to, sort of behind closed doors. But it's still very early in the process, and I don't have many concrete names. Of course, the one that's been on the message board and one that does make a lot of sense is Greg Amodio from Duquesne. So that's really the one kind of concrete name we have to go on that'll probably definitely be on that hot board when it comes to the search. But as of right now, no other real names have surfaced, though I expect we'll probably start to hear some in the next 1 to 2 weeks.
You know, I actually would expect that at least from you and I's perspective, we're probably not going to – this is not going to be like a coaching search.
Exactly.
Where there are a lot of leaks from sources that can point us at the right targets. This is something that's going on with a whole different set of decision makers. So, you know, we'll see how it happens, but I certainly would expect, I mean, my expectation, just knowing how Xavier does business and has done business in the past, is that this will be a quick process. It'll be a very secretive process, and they'll have somebody in place for this transition well before Mike Babinski departs.
Well, Dan, the last time we were here talking on this podcast, we were talking about how Xavier maybe could turn things around and trying to draw positives from a 4-game losing skid. Things have changed pretty quickly since then.
We're good.
Yeah.
We're really good.
Yeah. They're now on a 3-game winning streak, all 3 games coming in their conference schedule. And I'm not going to say they've fixed their problems or it's been the most impressive run of basketball, but they have found ways to win these games. And each game has presented its own different set of problems and adversity to overcome. And each game we've seen a different guy or two sort of enter the mix and really help the team get over that hump. But there's also been some constants. The first constant has been Samaje Christen. Last night, if you didn't see the game, he finishes the game off with 5 seconds left on an and-one off-balance bank shot to lift Xavier over St. Bonaventure. It was a spectacular shot, but like I talked about in my article, the more spectacular part of that game was the final 5 minutes where he absolutely just dominated. After having some issues earlier in the game, he missed shots early. He, you know, you could maybe see a little frustration, but that's one of the things that they've really been working with him, the coaching staff has, over the last several weeks, months, whatever, is not being so hard on himself and not getting his head down and not losing focus or getting himself out of his game because things don't go well. Last night, perfect example of that. He stays focused. He tears it up in the final 5 minutes, get Xavier a win in a tough environment, and I think you're starting to see some maturity from the freshman point guard.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The one thing that I thought was particularly good was the fact that he definitely is now stepping into that role as the offensive linchpin on the team. I think earlier this year we saw him hesitate to a certain extent to sort of take the reins of this team offensively. And I don't know why that is. It probably has to do with his elbow injury. It probably has to do with the fact that he is a freshman playing with a lot of guys who have some experience.
And the fact that, keep in mind, he's always been a pass-first point guard.
Samaje
Christen has never been a scorer, despite what every broadcaster seems to think.
Right, but this, but in these three contests this week, he's had, I believe, 14 field goal attempts in two games and 15 in the third. So that tells you that he's being more assertive and he's trying to get his shot and he's being aggressive. And I thought the biggest thing against St. Bonaventure was that, and we'll talk about each game in turn, but against St. Bonaventure, he, as he did against Purdue, was solid at the line down the stretch, which was very important, I thought, because, you know, his struggles with foul shooting have been obvious. They've continued even in the GW game. But against St. Bonaventure, they needed all those foul shots down the stretch. And I believe he was 6 of 7 from the line in the last 4 minutes of that game.
Yeah, he was 6 of 7 down the stretch, only missed that one off the end one, actually, the final game-winning shot he got an and-one on and couldn't put in the final free throw before St. Bonaventure went down and got their attempt blocked to end the game. He finished 7 of 9 for the game from the charity stripe, and that has been a big part of it. The other thing, though, you mentioned he's starting to take control of the offense. He's starting to really score the ball. He's been probably more impressive now as he ever has been this season at making plays for his teammates. Though last night he has 10 assists. We've seen a couple teams try to zone Xavier a little bit, and he's really just killed them. Every time a team has gone to a zone, he's found open men cutting to the basket for layups, it seems like, including Redford last night.
And that was the next thing. I mean, Brad Redford over the last three games has stepped into the breach left when D. Davis had to leave the Temple game with a sprained wrist, missed the last two games. And Redford has just stepped in and has done what we have seen seniors do at Xavier for years. Even guys like Brad, who maybe in the first 3 years of eligibility were not huge scorers or didn't play huge roles. Brad has been it's sort of that next man up mentality that Chris Mack has tried to inculcate with his players, and Redford has just been superb over the last few. The thing with Brad is he's got weaknesses, but he does one thing extraordinarily well. And when he's hitting his threes, he is such a potent offensive weapon for the Musketeers. Now, if he goes out and he shoots 2 for 9, that's a problem. But if he goes out there and he's getting open looks and he's knocking down 5, 6 threes in a game, it opens up the floor for a guy like Travis Taylor, who's continued his consistent play, for a guy like Isaiah Fillmore. And it also forces another defender to always be out on the perimeter so Samaje has a little bit more room to work.
And that's a very good point. And that was one thing that I think D. Davis was doing a better job of earlier in the year. And he was shooting a high percentage, but the biggest thing necessarily wasn't that he's making all of them, but just that he was being aggressive in attempting those three-pointers. He's kind of tailed off leading up to his injury. He hadn't been shooting near as much, especially from the outside. And I agree. I think that's kind of allowed teams to really slough off into the lane and try to take away driving lanes from Samaje. And maybe part of Redford, or maybe part of Samaje's recent success and him sort of getting back on a roll offensively has been due to Brad's recent play on the offensive end and him seeing more minutes and thus more shots. You go back, you know, the last two games, Brad has been spectacular. But even going back to the Temple game, when D first got hurt, Redford didn't play quite as many minutes in that game as obviously as the last two with D out. But he still goes 3 for 6, gives the team 9 points against a good Temple team. And you saw how much of a difference, even though, yeah, Xavier only scored 57 points, this team is good enough defensively, and they play so hard that they've been able to stay in every game this year, regardless of who the competition has been. They beat Butler holding them to 47 points. They beat Purdue holding them to 57 points. They beat they lost to Tennessee holding them to 51. They've been able to hold good teams down offensively. So if they can just get that extra notch from whoever it is, and in this case Redford has shown to step up and really provide that instant offense, he only needs a few shots to give you those 9 points. It makes such a big difference for this team. And I think really that more than any other reason is why we've seen the success over the last three games.
Well, another thing, I think Redford is one of those guys that because he's experienced and because he needs virtually no time to get his shot off, I think he's a guy that as we go through the conference schedule is going to be more and more important, because when X plays teams against whom or that do not have elite athleticism, So, like, throw VCU out, maybe even throw Dayton out. But a lot of the mid to lower tier A-10 schools, they don't have real quick guards. They don't have real big guards. And against those teams, if you can get Redford like he did against GW, 10 shots, if you can get him 16 shots like he had against St. Bonaventure, he's going to kill the other team. And so I absolutely believe that Brad's increased production. I do believe that Brad and Samaje sort of have this symbiotic relationship that they feed into each other's games. And I think it's a sort of an odd couple situation when you think about those two guys and their games, but they really do seem to mesh well together when they're out on the court at the same time.
Two things on that real quick, and I'll let you get back to what you were going to say. One, the relationship between Brad and Samaje that you mentioned is very interesting to me, because since Samaje has stepped on campus, Brad has been the one guy that, like, has been Samaje's go-to guy on the court. He has always looked for Brad. I mean, starting in open gyms back in the summer, it's like, man, every time he has an opportunity, he's trying to throw it, whether it be in transition and he's throwing it back across the court to the wing to Brad, or whatever the case may be, he's always looked for Brad. And that's really carried over to the games. And the more we've seen Brad on the court in the last two games, playing 35 minutes against George Washington, 36 against St. Bonaventure, we've seen Samaje really feed him and get him some open looks. And with Samaje being such a great creator and passer, he's able to do that. I'm sorry, go ahead with what you were going to say now.
Well, last thing I wanted to bring up before we start talking about the individual games and then talk a little bit about what's to come is you really have to take your hat off to not only the players for dealing with the adversity over the last three games, but also the coaching staff. Against Temple, we've talked all year that the most devastating thing about Samaje's cramping issues is that they're unforeseeable and they leave the coaching staff without their best player, and it could happen at any moment during the game and it's completely unpredictable. Against Temple, we saw the cramping issues come up, but we also saw the D. Davis injury in the first half. And so with 27 minutes left in that game, D. Davis goes off with that wrist injury, and no one really had a clue how Xavier was going to deal with it. And X really played the last couple of four-minute wars and then the whole second half against Temple. And we can lead in, I guess, to the Temple discussion now. They came out in the second half, and no one had a clue how they were going to patch it together and get 20 minutes out of them, especially when Samaje started cramping up. But they found ways to do it. They found ways by buying Samaje a few extra minutes of rest at TV timeouts, by taking him out for a possession or two beforehand. They found ways of using Landon Amos almost as a two in certain scenarios, and having guys that don't normally handle the ball, like Travis Taylor and Landon, who are able to handle the ball. I mean, they're not guards by any stretch of the imagination, but they're not embarrassing themselves out there. They just found ways. They went zone a little bit against Temple. They went zone a little bit against St. Bonaventure to rest legs. It reminded me, Rick, of a couple years ago when X was down to three perimeter players after Brad got hurt and Martin was ineligible.
Don't forget about Nighthawk.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Well, yeah, I mean, but that was what they did, is they used Feeney. And they used different lineups, and they used these little tricks to get Two and Mark and Dante some extra rest, keep them out of foul trouble in the first half by playing with the break on a little bit, and it works. And they've really shown an ability. I think if there's one thing that I've been most impressed with Chris Mack, it's his ability to adapt to adversity. You know, you can say that some of the adversity it could be, you know, foreseeable because they've had the issues with eligibility and they've had some of these personnel problems. But you really have to admire what they've done to adjust during games and during these stretches. And especially right now when you're in league play and they're going to be playing two games a week from now till the rest of the season.
Yeah, you're exactly right. This coaching staff, too. Piggybacking on what you just said, I've loved what they've done offensively. With just, it changes every single game. I mean, and that probably just has to do with, well, it does have to do with the personnel that they have not being very consistent and having to deal with some young guys, some guys going out of the lineup. what have you, they've done a great job of just feeding the hot hand from game to game and kind of making the offense revolve around that person. Last night we saw it with Redford in the St. Bonaventure game, and you mentioned he takes 16 shots in that game, which, thinking back to last year, at any point during last year, if I would have told you that Redford would attempt 16 shots in the third conference game of the season, you would have been beside yourself. I mean, it would have been a bad omen for this team. But last night, they're running their offense through him, running him off screens, running him through the baseline, chasing the defenders ragged, and it worked out great for him. I mean, yes, he missed some shots. Yes, he forced some things, but it took some pressure off the other guys, allowed some of the other guys to really just attack the offensive glass and focus on that, focus on screening and then getting to the glass. They grabbed 16 offensive rebounds, which was a huge key in the game. The whole offensive dynamic seems to change every game, I guess, is my point. And the coaches find a way to make it work. You got to take your hats off to Chris Mack, the staff, especially Travis Steele, who runs kind of an offensive coordinator role on the staff.
Well, I guess if there is a slight advantage to having a team that's incredibly inconsistent, where there's only one guy really that you know what you're going to get every night, is you can be flexible because you've got to be able to find the hot man. I thought that the critical point – let's talk about the Temple game first. First of all, I thought that this was as – the only game I can remember at Cintas Center where it felt like Xavier overcame more to win a ball game was that 51-49 game against Butler a few years ago.
Yeah.
This was just it felt like a Xavier team that came into the game with their backs against a wall, and they started off very strong, and they played really well in the first half. And then, to me, the most critical thing was they come out of halftime. They're up 29-26. They've struggled out of the locker room all season. They'd lost D. Davis. They were looking at 20 minutes against Temple. They knew Khalif Wyatt had hit that step back jumper at the buzzer in the first half, so he obviously was starting to feel it. And they immediately go into this disastrous about a 4 minute run where Temple threatens to blow them off the floor. Really, actually, it was more like 3 minutes. It was a 9-0 run right out of the box, and it was everything bad that we've seen from Xavier all season long when they've lost games: missing easy shots, stupid turnovers, not just stupid turnovers, but pick six type turnovers. And then a funny thing happened with about 17:38 to go in that game. Chris Mack called a timeout. He put the ball in Samaje Kristen's hands. He scored a basket. The Muskies got the ball back. Kristen again got to the line. And then Justin Martin hits a jumper, and the game's tied a minute later. And so instead of X being in this situation where they find themselves down double digits and looking at another slog to another loss, they're back in the game. And then Martin, you know, hits a three right after that, and they've got the lead. So that, to me, was if this Xavier season turns around, and if this team makes a run at an Atlantic 10 regular season crown, or even just at a top four type finish in the Atlantic 10, I think you will look at that stretch from about the 17:30 mark, that timeout, to about the under 16 timeout of that second half, and that will be the turning point.
And if that does happen, I think you should just schedule Temple like 5 times throughout the season every year, because we just talked about this on the last podcast. It seems like when they play these guys, for whatever reason, they hit that extra gear, they figure things out, and then it sometimes can propel them to a successful rest of the Atlantic 10 schedule. And so far we've seen that. Let's not get ahead of ourselves. GW and St. Bonaventure both kind of crappy, but they're playing pretty good basketball. You hit the nail on the head, though, with that part about the first run. And what did they do in that run? And not only that run, but the two games we've seen since then, both GW and St. Bonaventure, they both made runs too. But this has been a theme we've talked about throughout the podcast this year, and that's limit the runs. Instead of, you know, in the past, you know, we talked about 8-2 runs, 10-0 runs. Those always happen in basketball. But Xavier was having these runs where they can't score at all for 4-5 minutes. And teams end up going
against Tennessee, 10 minutes.
Yeah, exactly. And teams end up going on these runs that are just disaster. I mean, you can't overcome a 14-point run, a 16-point run. But if you limit to 8 to 10, you're still in the game. And that's exactly what Xavier did in that Temple game. They got their doors blown off for the first few minutes of that second half, like you just broke down for us. But it was only a 9-2 run. And that's a big difference. That's a big difference when you're talking about trying to chase 10 points or just trying to come back from a 5 or 6 point deficit like they did in that game. And that's why they've been able to overcome adversity, because it never gets quite to the point where it has earlier in the season, especially in that 4-game losing skid.
Well, and another thing about the Temple game is that actually X went on one of those sort of glacial runs we've talked about this year, where they'll hold the other team down, but they actually showed a little bit of what Clark Kellogg calls spurtability at about the 10-minute mark, when they went through that period where Redford hit a couple threes, they got a couple foul shots. Redford hit back-to-back threes. There was I think Taylor got a few foul shots and pushed the lead up to 11 with about 8 minutes left, and that really was it. That really. Although Temple did come back and they got it down to 2 points and the game was on a knife's edge as it went down the stretch, that was such a huge sequence of play, especially with Dee Davis off the floor. And the funny thing was, a lot of that happened without Samaje out there. In fact, I think that run occurred with a five on the floor for X that included Eric Stenger and Landon Amos
at the same time. Yes,
which is. You talk about things I would not have believed 12 months ago, but for X to make a big run against Temple and secure a home win, in large part due to the efforts of Eric Stenger and Landon Amos being on the floor at the same time, I'd have thrown my hands up, you know. So that obviously was pretty big. So X gets the win over Temple. It wasn't, you know. Let's be honest. Temple didn't play particularly well in that game.
No, but I think a lot of that Temple's had to a good do, team.
Yeah, they are. And a lot of that I think had to do with Xavier's defensive effort. Temple was limited to just 34% from the field. They were only able to get to the line a total of 10 times during the game. X, for their part, shot 41%. Granted, they didn't shoot a very good percentage in the second half, but they did hit 11 of 15 foul shots in the second half after going 2 of 6 in the first. And that allowed them to hold Temple at bay, especially down the stretch as the Owls made a little bit of a run.
One more real quick point on that. Again, Temple 52 points. You talked about Xavier holding them down like they've done other teams. They give them just 26 points in both halves. And, yeah, Temple didn't play that great. And, yes, Xavier held them down that way. But one thing we've seen from this Xavier team on the defensive end is when teams can hit threes and they've got great perimeter players that can kind of stretch them out, they struggle, which I'm sure you can say about almost any team when you look at the stats. But this Xavier team has seemed to struggle when other teams score with their perimeter players. But when it comes down to toughness and scoring in the paint, which Temple is basically a team that relies on three or four guys over 6'6", 6'7", to score in the lane, they don't shoot it well from the outside. Xavier has shown a lot of toughness out of a team that maybe had its toughness questioned earlier in the year. They've shown a lot of toughness, and they've shown the ability to shut teams down inside the paint and be the more physical, more aggressive, higher motor ball club inside.
You mentioned the rebounding effort, and that was obviously critical in the Temple game. Muskies had a short turnaround from the Thursday night game to the game against GW on Saturday afternoon. I was out of town. I didn't get to see the game. I saw a little bit. I saw most of the second half, I guess, on a replay the next day. But it felt like a game where the Muskies used a big run at the end of the first half to build a lead, and even though they were sloppy coming out in the second half, kept GW at bay pretty well in the second half.
Yeah, that was pretty much it. And again, much like the St. Bonaventure game that we'll get into in a second, I've kind of already talked about, Redford carried this team with his offense through the first half. He hit three threes, three of his four threes in the first half. And it was huge for this team to kind of keep them going. And again, their defense has been so good, they don't need a whole lot. But this game, they actually did find some offense outside of Redford. And a big part of that was Jeff Robinson being being really aggressive, which stretched GW's defense out. Robinson, right from the get-go, was knocking down 17-footers that day, and he had about three or four jumpers all in the first half. And it really stretched their defense out, so much so that at one point they ended up going to a zone just because they were having trouble kind of chasing Xavier all around the perimeter with both Redford hitting and now Robinson hitting jumpers. And their defense was just getting so stretched out, they tried to pack it in and play a zone. And then when they did that, you've got Samaje and Travis Taylor, of all people, just dropping dimes left and right. Taylor finishes with 11 rebounds and 6 assists, and he never really scored as much in that game and didn't bring sort of the inside post presence we've seen in games past. But he played a huge role in that win because of the small things he did. Again, double-digit rebounds and 6 assists, most of them coming against that zone where he was catching the ball and finding guys quickly as the defense tried to collapse. It was a more good offense from this team than we've seen probably in one game wrapped in that 40-minute period against George Washington.
Well, they shot 57% from the field. When you do that, you know, you're going to win almost every time. But when you get Brad Redford, the number of open looks that he had in that game, he's going to knock him down. And that was one thing. Watching the second half, I knew that X had been up 15 at halftime, and I knew that Redford had hit three threes. In the second half, again, just as we saw in the St. Bonaventure game, he became the focal point of the offense to a certain extent because you always have to sell out when he's on the floor. And it's been a long time. It's certainly unprecedented this year to see a Xavier team hit 8 of 10 three-point shots, but when Brad gets 8 of those attempts and he's open on most of them, you can pretty much put that in the bank. I thought it was critical in this game. They didn't really get much from Justin Martin. He was in foul trouble. As you said, Travis Taylor did a lot of things, but scoring wasn't really the primary focus of his game, and Isaiah Fillmore didn't give him a whole lot. But they did get – but, you know, there's the great enigma. Jeff Robinson steps in, and he puts up 14 points, 6 rebounds in this game, and that is the difference. They don't have D. Davis. They didn't have D. Davis. They needed somebody to step up as an option, and if Jeff has confidence to shoot those 17-footers, that's great. But just two nights before against Temple, we saw him have, from an offensive perspective, just a nightmarish game. He missed several point-blank layups in the second half that had people just – and then took that ill-advised three with 30 seconds on the shot clock in the last 2 minutes that had people just tearing their hair out in the stands. Now, he did make a great defensive play, don't get me wrong. But, you know, it's just what we've unfortunately come to expect with Jeff, which is that you just never know what you're going to get. But when he puts up a good game, X has a real good chance to win.
Yeah, that's been the case all year. And just, again, hitting on that point of the toughness and effort inside that I mentioned about the Temple game, 22-6. That's rebounding differential in the first half of that George Washington game. Xavier out-rebounded them 22-6. How in the hell do you only come up with 6 rebounds? That is mind-boggling, but again, credit Xavier for the effort that they've had. And just, if the other team's not going to be aggressive, you sure as heck better be, and that's exactly what Xavier did. They took advantage of it.
Yeah, I remember the last time X played at Kansas State, which I think was Jordan Crawford's year with the Musketeers. They took a deficit about like that rebounding in Manhattan, Kansas. I remember that game and just being befuddled at how it was possible to get so few rebounds. So the Muskies went, after securing those two wins at home, they went on the road to St. Bonaventure on what was last night. We're recording this on Thursday night. And went to the Riley Center. It's been a house of horrors in the past.
A Muskies, house of what?
A house of horrors.
Oh, for a second it sounded like a fun place to go to.
Well, no, the Riley Center is not a brothel. Let me just be clear. So they go up to St. Bonaventure. That's been a tough place to play over the years, although I know X, I think, has won their last 2 or 3 trips up there. And despite the fact that St. Bonaventure had a pretty bad record this year, was actually an underdog going into that game, if I understand that right. They were a 2 or 3 point underdog on the Vegas line.
That's correct.
So the Muskies did a pretty decent job. And again, you know, they were perfectly fine. They came out really, really strong in the first half, built an 8-9 point lead, let it slip away from them a little bit at the end of the first half, and then at the beginning of the second half, and found themselves in yet another dogfight. But this time, Rick, instead of when the Bonaventure run came, again, just as we talked about in the Temple game, when the Bonaventure run came, the Musketeers responded to it.
Yeah, and not only did they respond, but they just never let it get out of hand. Runs are going to happen. But college basketball is a game of runs. Basketball is a game of runs. But you can't give up those ridiculous deficits that Xavier has done at times this year. And again, you're right. They showed the ability to weather the storm, so to speak, using that cliche, and just stay in the game, stay within striking distance, stay close. And that's all this team needs to do, because defensively they'll give themselves enough opportunity if they can find the points. And, you know, we talked about the offense with Redford. They're running the offense through Redford most of the game last night. Or not most of the game, but a good portion of the game, where they're really just feeding him on every possession and kind of letting, other than that, Kristen create for people and go off ball screens after the defense kind of got worried about focusing on Redford. And, you know, they played some matchup zone against Xavier last night. As I mentioned, teams are trying to do that more, and I'm not real sure why, because it seems like it's helped Xavier's offense out when teams have gone to that. But they go through all of that, and they're in a position to win the game at the end like they've been so many times this year. But the difference is this time, they have someone come up with the winning plays, as we talked about already. Samaje Kristen, in the last 5 minutes of that game, scored 9 points, and it was just about every possession down. They just had no answer for him. They couldn't find a way to stop him. He willed Xavier to that win in the final several possessions, and it was an impressive performance, but it said a lot about his makeup, his character, and where he's come from since the beginning of this year.
Yeah, it just showed confidence. And you referred to it as sort of the beginning. To you, it was sort of the beginning of the Samaje Kristen era, I guess, because it felt like the first game. You could argue the Purdue game falls under this too, but it felt like the first game. That was a two Holloway last 5 minutes.
Exactly, exactly.
That was a Jordan Crawford last 5 minutes. That was a David West last 5 minutes. I mean, that was a guy who wanted the ball in his hands, who he knew that he was going to take those shots. St. Bonaventure knew he was going to take those shots, and they still couldn't stop him. I also, you know, you may have stumbled, by the way, Rick, you may have stumbled on something there when we were talking about this, when we were introing this game. Maybe I should call the Olean, New York Chamber of Commerce and suggest that they legalize prostitution, because that might be the only way to get people to go.
It'd be better attendance. attendance for sure.
Yeah, just I guess you would not, you would want to shut that down, I guess, when UD came to town.
Hey, all I know is we take those steps, and I might make my first trip to Olean, New York. But getting back to the game, you're talking about Kristen and the way that he knew he was going to take those shots down the stretch. That was the biggest thing to me. Because if you remember, even going back to the Wofford game, where they closed, and I shouldn't say they closed because of how it actually finished. But Redford made those two ridiculous desperation threes to get them back tied. Even on that last possession where Redford made that final three, Kristen had the ball in his hands and was looking to drive in a very similar situation to what he had last night on that final play. And the ball went to Redford for the final three. It wasn't the wrong play. He did a great job of drawing the man. But last night, he had Justin Martin on the wing, Redford in the opposite corner. The play was designed to give him a few options if the defense collapsed. Guess what? Justin Martin's man completely left. Justin Martin turned around to face Samaje and fouled him. There was zero thought of giving that ball up. Samaje knew he was scoring that whole way. And to me, there's a big difference between those two plays.
So the Musketeers secure a big road win in Olean, their first road A-10 game of the season. They move to 3-0, joining VCU, Butler, and some others atop the A-10 standings. And they'll be back in action on Saturday afternoon at the Cintas Center against LaSalle. First of all, good news. Last week when we were talking about the Temple game, we discussed the TV snafu and that a lot of the out-of-state XU fans and in-state XU fans that weren't Time Warner subscribers were being locked out of those games. This has been – Tom Iser had some tweets today. I would encourage you to go check that out. But it appears that if you are out of state, and I believe in state too, you'll be able to stream those games from the Xavier Athletic Department website, gozavier.com. Rick, looking at LaSalle, they actually are surprisingly to me, they're a top 40 RPI team. And if you believe in the RPI, there's only a handful of teams on Xavier's schedule that actually have a higher RPI at this point. UC, Butler, maybe one or two others. So, but as I look at their results this year, they don't really have that many impressive victories. They did beat Villanova at home, but Nova's a bit of a mess right now. And I guess I would say their best wins were two home wins in their last two A-10 games against Richmond, and then beating the Dayton Flyers on Wednesday night, 72-70.
Yeah, and you're right. They don't have a lot of impressive wins. The win over Villanova is kind of telling as to why they win and why they've had success though this year. And that's they have very good guards, which if you know much about Villanova, they don't have any right now, or ones that are playing well. So obviously, D. Davis becomes important for this game. Will he be back or not? Because if not, it's going to be really interesting to see how Xavier's able to handle LaSalle. They run a lot of guards at you. Basically, all of their best players are guards. Of course, we all remember Ramon Galloway. He's still their leading scorer. But they've got some other fresh faces in here that have played really well and are seeing a lot of minutes. And it's just going to be hard to, in my opinion, hard to overcome all this time on the floor against really good guards, especially on the defensive end, if D. Davis isn't in that lineup. And if he is in that lineup, which, to be honest with you, from what I've heard, what I'm gathering, there's no definitive answer either way. It's still day-to-day. It's still a game-time decision on Saturday afternoon. But I think he's going to try to play at least some. So if he does play like I expect, can he be himself and at least provide good defensive ball pressure and help Xavier out on that end to where they can spell Brad for minutes, they can get him off the court defensively, and hopefully they're able to get Brad going with a couple quick threes offensively. And this goes into another thing that we didn't really hit on that I want to talk about earlier when we were talking about Redford and Samaje's relationship, and that's where does it go from here, and where does it go if Davis comes back into the lineup? Does Redford continue to see more minutes? Does Xavier continue to try to get him more shots and run some more offense through him? Do they give him and Samaje just more time on the court together because of what they've been able to show him to sort of create and give this offense a little charge?
Yeah, this LaSalle game feels to me like a game, and I know Chris Mack doesn't like to do this, but it feels like a game where we might see X play a little zone. As you said, almost all of LaSalle's critical players are guards, but they're not a great three-point shooting team. They're at 34.9% for the season. That's a little bit above average in Division I, but in their conference games, they've only shot 32%. So, you know, maybe this is a game where they decide to pack it in a little bit. One thing that LaSalle doesn't do, on the other hand, is they don't get to the foul line very often. Their free throw rate is 268th in D1. So they're not a team that's going to kill you at the foul line. It'll be interesting to see how X attacks this from a game plan situation. I think a lot of that is going to depend on how much they realistically can get from D.
I think that's a huge part of it. The other thing is, I guess we would expect Samaje to be guarding Ramon Galloway. So, like you said, it's good that they don't draw a lot of fouls, but we know what Ramon Galloway is capable of, and you hope one Samaje, they can't afford to put him in foul trouble. So, if he does have to guard Galloway, is he able to do so without fouling? That's going to be a big key. And then I think offensively for Xavier, here's where they can really have an advantage, and that's inside with Travis Taylor, maybe a Robinson or Fillmore if they can get it going, but you can't really count on that. So what does Travis Taylor provide in this game? I mean, he's been playing really well, and he's been consistent. He's been giving the team what they need. But he hasn't scored quite as much the last couple of games, including last night. So does he kind of maybe come back with one of those 14-point games or you know, a little more scoring punch? Because I do think that's an area where Xavier will have an advantage in this game.
Well, as we look at this big picture, after the LaSalle game, the Muskies enter into a period from the the 20th of January to the 20th of February, where they will play six of their next, including LaSalle, six of their next nine games on the road, and that pretty much will wrap up their A-10 road schedule, except for the season-ending game at Hinkle Fieldhouse against Butler. And this first road trip, I think these next three games, or maybe let's say the next four games, are going to give you a pretty good signpost about where this team is going. LaSalle is a team, like the road St. Bonaventure game, playing LaSalle at home. If X is for real, if they're going to continue this upward trajectory we've seen over the last week or so, that's a game they probably need to win. And then they go on the road to play Charlotte and St. Joe's, two teams that have been pretty impressive so far this year. St. Joe's is considered by most people to be an A-10 favorite, or at least among that group of A-10 contenders. Charlotte has sort of been a dark horse so far this season. And if the Muskies were to beat LaSalle and get a split out of that road trip, I think you could. I think that would set them up for a pretty good run in. Because the whole thing is, once this period of all these road games ends, from the 23rd of February to the 6th of March, they play VCU, Memphis, UMass, and St. Louis all at home, four straight home games in the most tense circumstances. So for me, I look at where Xavier is right now. When we talked last week, I think I said that according to RPI forecast, they were at 133 in the RPI. I think as of today, they're at about 83. So they're back at least in the discussion. It's going to take some wins. It's going to take some road wins. It's going to take gutting out some victories against some teams like St. Bonaventure that aren't very good but can be dangerous on the road. But they do have an opportunity to get this to get this season back on track if they can produce road performances like they did against Bonaventure down the stretch.
Yeah, and the crazy thing about the season has been it really hasn't seemed to matter who they play. I mean, the results have been similar for almost every game that they've been in. It's been a few points here, a few points there, and it's been the same issues, the same problems, the same type of runs when they've lost that have killed them. I think they have a chance. You know, you talk about that murderer's row stretch that they have at home with VCU, Memphis, UMass, and St. Louis at the end, and then Butler on the road to finish up the schedule. And it's not out of the realm of possibility that they, you know, win two or three of those games at least. So if you think of it from that perspective, this stretch coming up right here is absolutely huge. Starting with this LaSalle game is one of the better teams, and then Charlotte and St. Joe's are both good too. Then you have a stretch with Dayton, Richmond, Duquesne, Fordham that you probably can maybe take three or four in a row. This team certainly has a chance to get on a roll here in A-10 play and still make a run at this thing. And, of course, never forget the Atlantic 10 tournament where when Xavier's needed it the most – they've always been successful in the A-10 tournament.
Right, right. So that pretty much wraps it up for for last week's games and a little bit of a look forward. You wanted to give us a quick update on one particular recruiting target that's been on your radar screen recently, obviously from your neck of the woods.
Yeah, for those, I think everyone knows that I cover high school sports in Northern Kentucky for another publication as in addition to Musketeer Report. And we don't get a ton of prospects around here, but it looks like one has surfaced. And as a kid that I liked last year and had kind of kept under my hat a little bit, and he's starting to emerge this year. He's grown a lot. He's gotten more athletic, and he's about a 5'10 point guard right now at Holmes High School in Covington. James Bolden, you probably have seen his name and seen the post on the message board. Chris Mack went and watched his game at Covington Catholic last week, and he scored 27 in a big win. And Cove Cath is one of the better teams around here, if you didn't know. So he scored 27 that game. Mack sees him. It looks like Xavier's going to continue to recruit him a little bit and pick that up. He was at the game on Saturday, had a great visit. I've got an interview coming on Musketeer Report, so watch out for that about his visit. But he's excited about the process. I know UC was at his game tonight, Thursday night, at Scott. Keep an eye on him. Again, as far as his game goes, super slippery with the ball in his hands. I mean, just has every move, tons of crossovers, making guys fall. He's got great explosion and quickness in and out of his cuts and his moves when he's dribbling the ball. And the one thing is, last year, he had kind of a funky shot that was really inconsistent and had a whole lot of motion to it. This year, he's really made that shot more concise, more fundamentally sound, and he's shooting a much higher percentage. It's going to be really interesting to see how he develops if he gets a little bit bigger. And he's already got the athleticism. He's able to dunk. Again, at 5'10", he can dunk with two hands off of basically a standing jump. So definitely a guy to keep on the radar, a local guy that'll be pretty easy to get out and see if you're interested in that. I'll post his remaining schedule on the message board for those who might want to check him out.
Well, you got Shane Hall and Bolden now as targets in the next couple classes. So
yeah. I don't know how much you want to go down and check Shane Hall out there. That is one hell of a haul, and you might be seeing him play against like some guys that look like me and Snow out there. So,
okay, Rick, last topic for today. On the list of bizarre sports stories in you and I's lifetime, where does this Manti Te'o thing rank?
It's up there. See, for me, it's probably the weirdest, to be honest. And I know we kind of went through the list before we started talking about it, and a couple of things that you try to throw out there would be the O.J. Bronco story, when he, you know, the car chase of the O.J. thing, and then what ensued initially was kind of crazy. But to me, I can picture killing a woman a lot easier than I can dating one online for 3 years without ever meeting them. So I still think this is the most weird thing that I've encountered. Second for me would be the Tonya Harding, Nancy Kerrigan deal, and then I would have OJ third probably.
Yeah, I mean the Harding Kerrigan thing was basically right out of a soap opera. I will say that I think the OJ double murder, although he was acquitted of it, but later found civilly liable. I would say that is the craziest thing, because as that 30 for 30 documentary made clear, it all happened on the same day that there were all these other crazy things going on in the sports world. And it was just – I remember being glued to my TV that day and just watching the way things came out with Robert Kardashian and all those that other cast of characters, and that was nuts. The Manti Te'o situation, though, I think it's interesting for two reasons. Number one is that if you go to Every Day Should Be Saturday, the great college football blog, they had a post earlier this week, or I guess it was yesterday, that said, here's a list of all the people that were duped by the Manti Te'o fake girlfriend story. And it listed basically every media outlet in the country. People love the idea of this sort of love story type, the movie love story type scenario. And it was so romantic that I think everybody was like the fat guy in the pro wrestling video that says, "It's real to me, damn it." You know, everybody wanted it to be true so much that when you read like Pete Thamel, who's a great reporter, when you read the full transcript of his interview and you just look at it and you're like, look at all the holes that are in this story, and no one caught it. So that's the first thing that popped into my head as I read this is I was just like, how could every major media outlet in the country, except to their credit for Jack Dickey and Tim Burke at Deadspin, be fooled by this thing?
Well, here's the thing. Some of them weren't even fooled. And that's the unforgivable part about this. I can see you're dealing with a death, and it's a sensitive situation, and oh God, his grandma died too, and there's a lot going on, and you're just kind of feeling like, okay, I can't ask for this. So many other people have reported on it. I can see how some of the major organizations, it's still wrong, they didn't do their job correctly, but I could see how some of them just didn't check up on a few of the things that they should have checked up on their own, couldn't get the information from him, and was kind of like, man, he's going through a rough time. I'm just going to back off. This has to be true. I mean, who's going to make up a death? And, you know, who all these other people report on it, it has to be true. I can see that happening. The guy from ESPN who was defending all the media outlets last night, I can't remember his name. I'm sure other people know him, but he was a nobody to me. He said that he went and he checked for a death certificate, or he checked for the obituary first. Couldn't find anything. And this is a girl who had gotten a lot of national recognition, had no obituary about her in the paper, nothing from Stanford came out. He can't find anything. And then he goes to he searches a little farther and tries to get a death certificate and can't get that either. And then, of course, Manti had already denied anyone's request for a picture of him or anything like that. And then they still run with the story. That part's unforgivable to me. If you went and looked for an obituary and a death certificate, couldn't find that the death even happened, and you're just like, well, screw it. I mean, everyone's saying it. It's got to be true. I don't get – how can you run with the story as a journalist when you've looked for an obituary and a death certificate and can't even find that the death even happened? And you're just like, well, you know what? It's good enough for me that other people have ran with it.
Well, you know, and it didn't even need to go that far. I mean, all they needed to do – the story was that this girl was a student at Stanford.
Right.
That's one phone
Just
call.
Check if she was ever enrolled there.
So to me, I actually liked Tommy Craggs, who's the editor of Deadspin, gave an interview earlier today on some publication. I can't remember what it was. But he said, you know, if this was a situation where it was a beat writer trying to get 500 words on deadline on the night of, and he didn't have time to do this, that's one thing. Yep. But for all these fawning profiles, the SI cover story, et cetera, for everybody to repeat this garbage is incredible. The other thing that was interesting to me was Notre Dame's behavior as regards this, which I think is probably going to be the thing that's most scrutinized in the coming days, because it's eminently clear if you look at the timeline that they were still – that Notre Dame – that Tao and Notre Dame were still allowing – this story to be disseminated long after everyone knew it was a hoax. I mean, even by Jack Swarbrick, the AD at Notre Dame's own admission, and he said they knew about it December the 26th. It seems more likely that it was known prior to that. So that's another thing that doesn't quite add up. I have to say, those that thought that Xavier's reaction to the brawl, their PR reaction to the brawl was over the top and sort of unfortunate, probably you got to look at this and say this is way worse to me. But either way, it's a story that's going to be developing over the next couple of days. So I just figured I'd get your take on it real fast.
Yeah, just closing up on that thing. This is to me it wasn't a story I wanted to believe in, and it's the type of story I hate. Quit trying to make all of our athletes the next Tim Tebow. Quit trying to tell us feel-good stories, because I could make any kid out there that I cover look like a great kid by writing one story. And I don't understand our country's fascination with falling in love with these athletes and making them into such great people. Why can't we just enjoy them for the entertainment that they are and watch them do things that we can never dream of doing physically and athletically and focus on that? That's the stuff I care about. I'll be honest with you, and this is the God's honest truth, I really didn't know the story about Tao's girlfriend leading up. And I'm not a huge college football guy. I watch it enough. But I'm going to guess that I had heard it a fair amount on ESPN or whatever, and pretty much just, you know, that was the time when they started bringing up that I went to get another beer, or I hopped on Twitter to read for the next 30 minutes, because I just don't care about that type of stuff when it comes to athletes. And this is exactly why. Because,
you know,
I really
you
don't
know
them.
To a certain extent – and I remember I wrote about this a few times on the blog when I was writing for Dana and Victory, that we have a tendency in this country, and especially in the especially ESPN, let's just say it right there, because they're the opinion makers in sports, to try to conflate positive character traits with winning. And we're more than willing to ignore the fact that Lance Armstrong is one of the world's biggest a-holes when he's winning 8 Tour de France's and is, you know, doing the Live Strong thing, et cetera. And the point, and you see it so many times, that when a team wins or when an athlete is successful, only their positive traits are emphasized in the press. And then when they're struggling, that's when you find out about Brett Favre and his addiction to painkillers, or him sending or him sexting Jen Sterger or whatever.
If only they would have had Snapchat back then.
So the bottom line is that I agree with you. I think that the attempts to make – I think that when the sports media attempts to transcend the actual games themselves and make it a human interest story, that's what leads to issues like this. Because if there wasn't any benefit to Manti Te'o or Notre Dame, I don't think this hoax would have been carried out to the extent that it was.
I agree.
But that's just my opinion.
Yeah, and there's tons more to this and more that's going to come out, and that's not our job to hit on, so we won't bore you anymore with it because I'm sure you listened to it all day.
Oh, and everybody, I'm sure, had stopped listening to this podcast 10 minutes ago. So,
yeah,
hi, Mom.
That's nice that your mama listened to it. I can't even get that much. But anyway, that brings us to the end of the AJ Green edition of the Dan and Victory podcast, available only on MusketeerReport.com. For Dan...
Can I make it the AJ Green / Ted Klazuski edition?
Yes, the big clue can definitely be included in this podcast for your preference. That does it. Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll see you next time.